Hello, it's Monday the 9th of August. I'm Richard Spur, sitting in for Andrew Pearce from the Daily Mail newsroom. Still to come. A scientist claimed that climate change is a statement of fact. How concerned should we be about the impact of global warming? On the eve of A-level result day, could the pandemic-related lack of exams mean boys will do worse than girls? You'll hear how a personal experience of grief sowed the seeds for a novel, how all the vitamins you'll ever need could soon pop out of a printer, and you'll get an update on the world of sport too. Humanity's damaging impact on the climate is a statement of fact, according to a landmark study by UN scientists published today. The report says that the current emissions of warming gases could also see the 1.5 degree warming limit broken in just over a decade, with disastrous results for the world's climate. Well, Amelia Womack is the deputy leader of the Green Party, and she joins me now. Amelia, in your view, just how worried should we be about the future?
I mean, we should be worried about the present as well as the future. You just need to look to Greece today and the fires that have happened there, the fires that have happened across North America during this year, the flooding that's happened in London, to know that climate change isn't at our door. It's now running through our train stations, our living rooms and our communities. So we need urgent action. This is what 1.1 degrees of warming looks like. We can't begin to imagine what 1.5 or even 2 degrees of warming can really mean to people and our communities. So this isn't just about the future, it's about addressing the risk in the here and now and realising that we need urgent action. It's like a horror movie, some of these images, and it's like the government's governments are sitting there like bystanders in this rather than taking the urgent action that's needed. I feel like as the Green Party, we've been showing the trailer for what this could look like, and now it's here. We're not seeing that action from our governments to mean that we're stopping those risks to people and the planet.
Well, sure. I mean, but government is always a juggling act. And, you know, to what extent do the economics of conforming to the changes we need to make affect the government's decision when it comes to our approach to climate change?
Well, the Stern Review that was released in 2007 showed that economically it's better to invest earlier in climate change, reducing our climate change risk and putting in place climate change adaptation. And the longer we leave it, the more we have to do to reverse the impacts of climate change. And some of those things we aren't going to be able to reverse, things like sea level rising. There's a time lag on what happens with sea level rises, and lots of that work has now been baked in for future generations and could take centuries to rebalance. Essentially, we need to be making sure that we are looking at the economics of this and making sure that the greenest option is the cheapest and easiest option for people. Things like putting in place a carbon tax is how you can change how people make decisions, while also ensuring that the money is there to put in place infrastructure projects, giving people access to public transport or home insulation, or creating the Green New Deal that we so desperately need to ensure that we're not just reducing our risk of climate change and keeping ourselves below 1.5 degrees of warming, but also by lifting people out of poverty and addressing many social justice issues that we have across our communities.
And obviously you're lobbying for political and governmental change when it comes to the way that we deal with this really rather prescient problem. But what can the individual do, and how can the individual react to the future that faces us?
Well, as the government's own spokesperson from COP has said, join the Green Party.
Alexis Stefan said you would say that.
But yeah, we also can't just have a hang-up on individual action. The default at the moment is puts forward a lot of carbon emissions. There are baked-in carbon emissions as a result of the government being too slow at putting in place basic policies to ensure that we're reducing our carbon emissions for this generation and generations to come. Things like the £27 billion road building programme. Yes, we can take individual action, but it's only by changing the structure in which we work that we're going to have a genuine impact. So I would encourage everyone to keep lobbying and petitioning and using their votes to ensure that we've got climate action, because yes, we can take individual steps, but it's only when the greenest option is the default option are we going to make a genuine difference to this emergency. And it is an emergency. This is a crisis. As I said, there have been homes in the UK that have been flooded, those fires that we've been witnessing, it's just horrifying to look at. And our risk is not being properly managed by the government, and it's them who will be able to create a world where, as I said, the greenest option is the cheapest and easiest option for everyone.
And just finally, as a party and speaking politically, you do have a very clear agenda, but you don't return many MPs. Do you think people simply are too sceptical about your focus when it comes to your status as a political party?
Well, across the country, we're winning in council elections, and every year we are increasing our number of councillors, doubling our number of councillors on occasions as well, because people not only see the climate agenda as a priority, but they also see hardworking people in their communities. We've had a few near misses on that second seat, and what people are starting to really say is they want to vote for what they believe in. And with these scenes from around the world, more and more people are looking to the Green Party for that leadership. So yes, it's not been easy in a first-past-the-post system, but in council elections, we've been proving that we can beat that. And in certain seats across the UK, if all of those people that voted Green in council elections vote Green in a general election, we can be returning even more Green MPs to raise the voice of Green ideas. Also, at the moment, Caroline Lucas, you know, she holds the government and the opposition to account. More voices like that is what we so desperately need.
Amelia, many thanks for taking the time. That was Amelia Womack, Deputy Leader of the Green Party. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to the Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Tomorrow, students up and down the country will be opening their A-level results, but in a year where a bumper crop of top grades are expected, could boys do worse than their female counterparts because of the lack of exams? Well, the former head of Harrow thinks so, claiming boys are often idle without the motivation of exams to revise for. Chris McGovern is the chairman of the Campaign for Real Education, and he joins me now. Chris, why is there this gender difference?
It's a very good question, but the headmaster concerned, who's the former head of Harrow, is of course head of a boys' school. Look, girls were outperforming boys when there were exams, so I think possibly he's right to suggest that boys prefer a final and end of two-year exam. But girls are outperforming boys at every level of education, right through to degree level. So whether we have continuous assessment or exams, or as this year we have teacher assessments, girls are outperforming boys. Why are they doing this? Well, that's the million-dollar question. I have to say, I think from an early age, girls tend to do better. They certainly have greater literacy skills in primary school. They tend to get a good start. It's also true to say probably that boys, by the time they get to 17, 18, are beginning to compete with girls in mathematics and physics. So there is some levelling out there. But, you know, primary schools are full of Hermione Grangers from Harry Potter, precocious, intelligent girls, delightful to teach. Boys sometimes in the shadows. You know, we tend to think that somehow girls get a rough deal in school, in education, and in life. But actually, you want to worry about the boys. It's the boys who are actually in the shadow of the girls, certainly in education. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why so many famous boys' schools have gone co-educational, not Harrow, but others, many have, is because they want to improve their results. So, you know, we have a lot of this talk from headmasters about the virtues of co-education, how it's preparing children for life. What they don't tell you is the truth, and the truth is the reason why boys' schools go co-ed is they want to improve their position in the league tables, to improve their results. From the point of view of girls, they're far better off in single-sex schools. In single-sex schools, you find that far higher proportions of girls tend to do the sciences and mathematics. And, you know, that's a good thing, I think. And therefore, they're not being gender stereotyped. But if you've got girls in co-educational schools, they tend to move towards the arts, with the English, to the languages and so forth. So, look, it's a complicated question. Girls outperform the boys anyway. And I think we need to take into account also that schools are dominated by females. You know, 9 women teachers for every 1 male teacher in primary school, and 2-1 in secondary school. So perhaps we need to have more male role models in schools.
I went to an all-boys independent school, Nottingham High School, that was founded back in 1513. They recently, or I say recently, a couple of years ago, became co-educational. Their motivations for doing that might have been financial, they might have been to do with results, but I doubt it's the latter, because in my year, we sent a record 26 boys to Oxford and Cambridge. When I was at school doing A-levels around about 25 years ago, that bottleneck, that educational curricular bottleneck of A-levels, was where boys did far better than girls. Girls having succeeded over boys at GCSE at A-level time, then boys always got better grades. What's changed?
Well, what's changed is a very good question. What's changed is that girls have got better or boys have got less good. The fact is that to some extent the curriculum has changed, and to some extent the curriculum has become different, maybe more feminized. Maybe boys don't see it as so much geared towards the interests of boys. That's debatable, of course. I certainly can say that if you go back 25, 30 years, you look at the pass rates, you will find that they were much lower than they are today. You will find that the exam was more demanding. Last summer, we had a pass rate at A level of 100%, and we had an increase in A and A star grades from 25% to 40%. So more and more youngsters are getting high grades. So what you have, in effect, is a levelling out. So the exam system is failing to differentiate. And that might well be one reason why boys do less well, or have done less well, and girls have moved up, because the average girl may be doing better than the average boy. But certainly the exam system which you took 25 years or so ago is not the same as the exam system today. And interestingly enough, it's true also of GCSE. You know, 30 years ago I was arguing then that by getting rid of the O-level exam, we were dumbing down the examination system. We introduced GCSE because it was an all-ability exam. We didn't want the grammar school exam, the O-level. But the interesting thing is today, in 2021, we still produce the O-level. We ban it in this country and sell it to Singapore and other countries abroad. And where is Singapore and the international league tables top?
Yeah,
so we've dumbed down the system.
You lead me on to my final question, which isn't gender specific, because they're doling out A's and A stars like anything. And this now leads universities to start considering maybe introducing their own exams to differentiate. The system simply isn't working, Chris.
No, it isn't working, and understand universities having to introduce their own exams. Look, the results we're having tomorrow, and they did on Thursday, are not A-level or GCSE results. They are teacher estimates, teacher assessments. And we know from recent work by the University of London that the accuracy rate of predictions by teachers for A-level is 16%. Teachers tend to err on the generous side. So, you know, we want a bit of honesty in the system. I think the Department for Education is basing its ideas on those of Groucho Marx, and that is that what's important in life is honesty. And if you can fake that, you'll be fine. And we have faking of it. We have fake exams coming out in the next few days. And also, you know, we've seen last year, similarly, we had the problem with the algorithm. And a couple of years ago, we had the head of the Ofqual, which is the government's advisory body, the watchdog for standards, telling the Sunday Times, all our children are brilliant. And that's probably the explanation why everybody's going to pass the exam this year. And if you believe that, then you'll believe in anything.
We'll leave it there, yes. Faking sincerity, that's the goal, isn't it? Chris, many thanks for taking
Thank
the time.
You very much.
Chris McGovern, chairman of the Campaign for Real Education. When Helen McGinn's brother Tom was stabbed to death in 2002, her world was turned upside down. Now she's turned her experiences of grief into a novel, Just One Day. She joins me now. You're also a wine writer, I understand, Helen. Would you begin, I'm sorry to ask, by just recontextualising the circumstances of your brother's death?
Yes, it was back in 2002, and my little brother Tim was, we both lived in London at the time, and he was just 25, and actually he very sadly died. He was the victim of a carjacking, and unfortunately when the attack happened, he was stabbed in the heart, and so he died in January 2002.
It's incredibly difficult. One can only imagine to find any sort of catharsis, creativity or constructiveness in the death of a loved one. But you seem to have managed to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken a while, to be fair. You know, it was nearly 20 years ago. It'll be 20 years next year. And, you know, it's taken a long time to come to terms with it. I think part of that is because when something like that happens so suddenly, so brutally, really, you know, obviously nothing can prepare you for that. And he was so young and we were really close. And, you know, that took a long time to really just even begin to understand or comprehend how that happened. You know, it is an ongoing journey, I have to say, but writing this book, it really felt like it was the time to write a book that did address grief and how it affects people in lots of different ways, and that there's no right or wrong way to go about it, because that's what I've really learned over the last 20 years.
And just talk a little bit about the narrative and about the journey on which you take the reader in this novel.
So in the novel, the central character, Flora, she has a brother called Billy, who she's really close to, and they're close in age. And Billy dies quite suddenly in a car accident. And again, really the story focuses on how Flora, how her parents, how Billy's friends all go through that process, really, of understanding their grief and coming to terms with what's happened. But I've also looked at it from another point of view, which is, for me, you know, the mother of the other person involved in the accident. You know, although she didn't technically lose a son, she still in a way went through, you know, a trauma of sorts. And so it was really just looking at all sides of it, rather than just focusing on one.
And is there anything apart from time that can ease the agony of grief?
I think, I mean, time is the key, definitely. But I think one thing that has really helped me is understanding that trying to make sense of something that makes no sense is sort of a waste of time.
Sure.
Because there is no logic in what happened. You know, it can't be explained. And if you ever start going down a what-if road, or, you know, if only road, you're just going to tie yourself up in knots. So it really, it takes time, but it's coming to that acceptance of what happened. And then you can just start to really instead focus your energies and your time on remembering all the good stuff, because all the good stuff is there. You just lose sight of it for a while. And as I say, really, it's just that has really helped me in the, you know, in the years since. I see a lot of his friends, and, you know, my family talk about him all the time. My children never knew him, but we have pictures everywhere. We often tell stories about him. So it's really just treasuring those memories and very much keeping them alive.
Do you think there's another novel in you?
There is. And I'm writing it at the moment.
I thought there might be.
Yeah, I wrote this last one in just one day, was written during lockdown. So it was a pretty intense period anyway. But I think looking back, it was the perfect time to write this book, because it really did focus the mind. And I knew that I was in the right place to be able to write it. And I just really hope that maybe the book might help other people who are perhaps going through this themselves, or, you know, struggling to come to terms with something similar, because it really is by reading these stories that I found it really helpful. And I kind of wish, you know, this book had been around for me to read then.
And I hope you don't feel I'm being flippant, but I, like you, am a great lover of wine. A bottle, perhaps, that you would recommend, Helen, to drink whilst consuming your book.
Well, funny enough, part of the book is set in Venice, which gave me the perfect excuse to write about food and drink, because obviously wine is very close to my heart. So I think with this book, the one thing that always, to me, makes me feel like I'm celebrating life is something with bubbles in it. So a really good bottle of Prosecco is what I will be sitting down with in the garden when the sun comes out.
Well, cheers to that. Many thanks, Helen McGinn, female wine writer and author of Just One Day. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus. Deputy sports editor Tim Nichols is here with the latest sports news. Tim, a very successful Olympics for Team GB.
A very successful second greatest Olympics we've ever had, with 65 medals, 22 gold, 21 silver, 22 bronze. It's only a couple behind Rio, which, when you consider we fell short really in rowing and athletics. We didn't do as well as we normally do there. Particularly rowing is a stronghold of British sport at the Olympics, and we really disappointed from what we're used to in those two sports, and yet we still ended up with 65 medals and just so many great stories across so many different sports and landmark achievements from individuals and teams. It was a fantastic games for Team GB. Really was a unexpectedly really. I don't think anyone quite envisage just bringing so much metal home with us.
Many people thought that the lack of spectators would be a bit of a downer when it came to morale, but we saw some superb performances despite the very unusual context, didn't we?
Absolutely, and I think they do make a huge difference, and particularly in these. These are not sort of the global sports that necessarily get the huge crowds normally away from the Olympics. And so this is really their moment in the sun, whether you're an athlete, whether it's a swimmer or cyclist or any of the disciplines in the Olympics. And so, I think that was a real blow and a real shame. But at the same time, I think the athletes from across every country, just once they turned up in Tokyo, it is the Olympic Games. They've all been building their lives towards it, or certainly the last 4 or 5 years towards it. And it's incredibly special. It's incredibly important to those people, and they all delivered fantastic performances. And obviously in Paris in 3 years' time, we want to see the crowds back, because it does make such a difference. And I do feel very, very sorry for the people of Tokyo and Japan, because, they were locked out of their own party. We remember what London was like here, 9 years ago, an absolutely fantastic time to be in this city and in the country. And it's a real shame that they missed out on that. But you've got to credit the athletes, because they didn't let it affect them and produce some absolutely stonking performances.
And the start of the new football season, Tim.
Yes, it feels like it's never been away after obviously the Euros and England's heartbreaking defeat in the final. But, the Football League season has already kicked off this weekend. Brilliant to see fans back in the grounds. And the Premier League kicks off on Friday. Brentford, the latest addition to the Premier League. They are taking on Arsenal on Friday night. And, it's going to be an interesting season. I'm expecting a tighter title race this season. I think Manchester City are obviously the team to beat. Jack Grealish is a great signing. They're probably going to end up with Harry Kane by the end of the transfer window as well. But Chelsea closing in on Lukaku for £100 million. I think that's the one thing missing from their team, was a sort of elite striker. Now they've got one, they are going to be a real contender. Liverpool, I expect to be better than last season. And Man United have had a good window by signing Sancho and Varane. So I think it could be a really exciting title race this season after, a few processions in recent seasons. Should be a good one.
Tim, many thanks for joining us. That was Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nichols there. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MailPlus. The health supplement market has boomed over lockdown. The chances are that you've got a bottle of multivitamin somewhere in your bathroom. But now a British company lets us print all the vitamins we need in a 3D tablet. Food writer Sudhi Pigott spoke to Melissa Snover, founder of Get Nourished. And Sudhi joins me now. What did you learn?
Well, I didn't really, to be honest, understand quite how 3D printing works, as I'm probably a bit old school when it comes to kind of techie things. So it was great to actually go up to Birmingham and see the printer working in real life and understand that it really is a physical process of making 3D objects from digital files, and quite incredible.
When we talk about printing something in 3D, what exactly does that mean?
It means that rather like with an inkjet printer, when you add dots to form an image. With a 3D printer, you actually add materials one layer at a time. So in this, you're making this stack of vitamins. So you literally put in what looks like a kind of firework, kind of capsules on a rod, and then put it through the printer, and it prints out these stacks of nourishment in the form of like a big bonbon, really.
The advice seems to change, as it always does with health. One minute, multivitamins and vitamin supplements are good for us; the other, they don't have any effect. What's the current view?
Well, I think, strictly speaking, most GPs would say that in an ideal world, if you knew what you were doing and spent the time shopping and cooking properly, you could get all the right vitamins you need from your food. And I, at heart, I like to agree with that, but I think the reality is for most of us that we're all rushing around so much, and that with best will in the world, but not necessarily thinking like, have I had this? Have I had enough of this week? Even if we try to do it. So that's really where something like this comes in. So it's a kind of one-shot way of ensuring that you're really looking after your body and in kind of optimum health, rather than just kind of getting by health.
And as a nation, are we undernourished? And what effect might that have on us in the future?
Well, I mean, I think it affects most people on a day-to-day basis, because I mean, I'm sure you've noticed amongst your friends and family, people are always complaining that they're tired, or they can't concentrate properly, or they haven't got much energy. And that's probably because their nutrition balance is a bit out of kilter. But, you know, in longer term, it can cause all sorts of things, from, you know, osteoporosis to, you know, other problems with your organs. But, you know, this is if you're severely malnourished. Otherwise, you may just not be feeling as good as you could be feeling. So it's quite difficult to monitor, really.
Sudhi, many thanks for your time. That was food writer Sudhi Pigott. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Richard Spur, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great evening. Good night.